This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It would be wonderful if we never had to open any bottles of wine, because that's the only way that when wine is bottled, it stays fresh. Once it reaches oxygen, which of course happens when you open the bottle, it starts to deteriorate. There's a fellow here in Northwest Indiana, a Purdue University engineering grad, and he's an engineer in the argon industry, which means he knows something about inert gases that in turn might help find a way to preserve wine in its best possible form so that you can enjoy it in the best possible way. We have with us Ryan Fredrickson to talk about his little invention. Ryan, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
Tell us first a little bit about yourself and what got you interested as not only an engineer, but also as somebody who obviously enjoys wine and you want to find a way to make it more enjoyable for everybody.
Like you said, I was an engineer in the argon industry, was traveling around quite a bit, almost like a corporate contractor for a company that was one of the largest inert gas companies in the world, and really got a chance and a taste for wine. But I was, you know, traveling, living alone, and noticed that it, as much as wine is great, you know, the taste, the aromas, and if you go out to the West Coast like I did, you get to see kind of the beauty of the vineyards and all the hard work that goes into every drop of wine. But at the end of the day, you're staring at five glasses in a single bottle of wine. And you kind of have to commit to the whole bottle if you don't want any of it to go to waste. So I kind of thought about that. You know, we were designing oxidation prevention systems for the food and wine industry, and kind of got to thinking, you know, maybe I can use my skills to actually, you know, decrease the waste. There was, we did some research, and it was about $1.5 to $2 billion of wine is going down the drain every year, which is, you know, besides being good wine, which is unfortunate, it's something that I wanted to prevent. You know, it's something that I thought I could prevent.
What a fantastic waste of wine, to be sure. Well, let me ask, what do you think about the, obviously there have been inventions in the past coming up with ways to cork up a bottle of wine to keep the freshness in there. What do you think about all these other gadgets and devices that have been put out there already to try to preserve the freshness of wine, and what was it that made you feel that you could do one better with your invention?
There's a lot of need, so there's always going to be lots of people trying to solve the problem. We did look at some of the things out there. You know, there's systems up to a couple thousand dollars that will preserve wine, and there have been some attempts using nitrogen gas, actually, that were similar to ours, and based on my background, I said, you know, nitrogen's just not the right gas to use. For an application like this, we should definitely use argon. It's going to work better for our customers, and we're going to actually be able to preserve wine a lot better, so it kind of, you know, it was a hard question to answer for myself, is what makes me think, eventually you got to say, what makes me better? And I think it was just a true desire to reduce waste, starting with wine and my background designing systems that prevent oxidation, that kind of hit the points on the head, I suppose.
Now, if somebody's interested in getting in ART Wine Preservers, first off, what does ART stand for?
Make fun of me, I'm an engineer first, right? ART stands for argon technology.
Well, I mean, you had to ask the question because, you know, it just makes sense that an engineer is going to come up with an idea first and they're going to find some way to if you can, put that into the name of your product, because then you always have to market the product, and that's the important thing now. If somebody wants to get this ART Wine Preserver, what are they going to have in their hand once the package arrives from wherever it comes from, and what can they do to help preserve the wine once they have that in hand?
To answer the first question, where, you know, it comes from Chicago suburbs, we manufacture every single piece here in the USA, and most of it actually locally. The Chicago suburbs, there's a great manufacturing group out there that does a good job. In terms of what it is, to visualize it for our customers, basically it's a small canister, very similar to like a miniature version of what we were using in the food industry for our, you know, your Kraft, your Purdue chicken, that sort of thing. Very, very similar to that. It's basically an aerosol can that is pure argon gas. Spray 2 seconds of this gas into your open bottle of wine. That's the dose we figured out that will create a protective layer over the wine within the open bottle. Then you stick a cork in it, and you're good for a couple of weeks.
That's great. That's great. Now, how has your marketing plan been going so far now to get this out so that more people have a chance to examine it and find out more and see if it really does make them feel happy about opening a bottle of wine?
The first place we've been going is wine professionals. to all your sales teams for distributors, your vineyards, that they're really concerned about their brand, and that every single drop of the wine that they're serving is at its peak. So we have we've talked with salespeople that have they're sampling bottles to their customers and trying to get them to buy. Trying to get them to buy a pallet of this stuff, so they really want it to be perfect, and they're some of the quickest to dump a bottle of wine. So our marketing plan actually is to target these wine professionals, get them to really test it out in the field a lot every single day, and that's been pretty successful so far, actually. And if you can get the wine professionals to use it and to say, hey, this is really working, that's something that we hope will then, they'll show their restaurant customers, and then once they start using it at the restaurant, the consumers will start to see it being used there. So really going from the wine professional down to the consumer.
You have this ARC Wine Preserver. Any other products that you're thinking of that you're going to be able to put out there that related to this, or maybe some other ideas that you've thought about in dealing with the issues of trying to preserve, in this case, wine, but in case foods and other types of things?
We're trying not to put the cart before the horse, but this is absolutely my personal mission, the company mission, is to reduce waste, and we're starting with wine. So there are some other ideas, but we're very much focused on preserving wine right now, and hopefully if we're able to successfully do that and grow as a company, we'll bring other waste reduction techniques to the food and other industries.
We're talking with Ryan Fredrickson, who is a Purdue University engineering graduate, and he's been an engineer in the Argonne industry, but he's come up with a better way to help preserve bottles of wine. Once you open them, they'll go stale, but not if you use his technology that's called ART Wine Preservation. Ryan, thanks for the information. Best of luck to you on this venture and others as well, and hope to see you out there with your spray can of Argonne and trying to preserve more bottles of wine everywhere.
Thank you, Chris.
By the way, if you want to check out his little invention, you can go to his website, which is artwinepreservation, that's all one word, .com, artwinepreservation.com.
I think that my role is to be accessible to the public, to listen to their concerns, be there for the officers, and also the employees of the Valparaiso Police Department.
That is the new police chief in Valparaiso, Jeff Ballin. We had a chance to talk with him the other day.
I feel that it's important that the police department and the community work together, and that's one of my responsibilities, is to facilitate that cooperation.
If you will, give us a brief look at your career. What's gotten you to this point is now the head of the department.
I've been in Valparaiso Police Department for a little over 25 years now. I started out in the patrol division, where I was promoted to corporal and eventually sergeant in 2004, when Chief Brickner took over the helm under Mayor Costas, I was laterally transferred into the detective division. At that point, I've been there for numerous years. Eventually, one of my duties was being a member of the Northwest Indiana Major Crimes Task Force. Eventually, I was appointed as the assistant commander of that task force, where we worked many homicides and other type of high-profile investigations. Mm-hmm. I was there for a few years, and then in 2015, I was appointed as the captain of investigations by Chief Brickner, which led me to this appointment by Mayor Costas when Chief Brickner retired.
Since you've had a chance to deal with high-profile crimes, you can certainly, I'm sure, have to include this in your total assessment of crimes in the city of Valparaiso. What do you see as the situation right now? There are a lot of crimes that probably go on that people are not aware of. There are also the high-profile things like the opioid crisis that lead to addictions and crimes that are related to that, too.
That is true. I think that is one of the driving factors for crime in Valpo. We're in a relatively safe community, and I believe, though, one of the factors for crime is the drug addictions.
Mm-hmm. You've had a chance over your 25 years with the police department to see the issue grow, unfortunately, and it's unfortunately grown out of seemingly out of control. when you started as a patrol officer with the Valparaiso Police Department, what incidents did you come across in your work on the street that gave you this clue that the problem with drugs, not only the opioids, but any substance abuse for that matter, what did you see the problem start to be a problem not only for the police, but for the community as well?
Well, that probably started early on in my career, just when you, as a patrol officer, a lot of your calls for service deals with theft reports, burglar reports, DUI enforcement, OWI enforcement, things like that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when you do come across the persons responsible, oftentimes they're willing to identify a reason for what they were doing. And a lot of times that was because of addiction issues.
So maybe even some cases you talk to people, not only people involved in victims of crimes for that matter, but people involved in crimes too, and you could probably tell for some cases they're high on something, I would imagine.
Well, we always want to find out why someone did what they did, and I think with any avenue, there's conversation needs to take place, and that's with victims, that's with our persons responsible for it. So, we always want to know why someone did what they did, just so we could help address problems in the future.
Now, besides the issue of drug abuse and addiction and the like and the crimes that come about from those types of incidents, what else do you see as the typical crime in the city of Valparaiso these days?
You have a lot, probably thefts. There's some burglaries. That's probably the majority of the type of crime that we do get.
Your time as a patrol officer and then as a detective with the Valparaiso Police Department had to give you a chance to check out some unusual, some high-profile crimes, some very dramatic crimes. I know it's not been all that many years ago that in the city of Valparaiso there was a hostage-taking incident that tied up police resources for quite a while until it was finally resolved. If you will, recall that for us and tell us how you helped with your colleagues there on the police department to basically resolve the problem.
Well, sure. I was part of the team that negotiated the release of those individuals that were taken hostage. Mm-hmm. So, but there were many people involved. The officers that initially responded, the SWAT team members, there were federal and local and state authorities that assisted with that.
Now, in your estimation, taking a look now at that crime that happened, how do you think the things were resolved? Pretty much, certainly to success, no one was seriously hurt or hurt, and the thing was resolved successfully. And you think that's the way that things have worked out well, and that's the way you kind of follow through to help keep the streets of Valparaiso safe?
Well, I think it's a group effort. I don't think that one particular individual can do everything, and I think it's important to have a team philosophy, a team concept that has things come together, hopefully so we can have good resolutions.
We're talking with Valparaiso Police Chief Jeff Ballin. He's been appointed by Mayor John Costas to take the position as the head of the department. Michael Brickner left to take a position in Porter County government. And Chief Ballin, you've talked about your thoughts about keeping the streets of Valparaiso safe. Are there any new initiatives or initiatives that you're continuing on as the police chief that you'd like to see to be able to reach those goals of making things safer for residents in Valparaiso?
Yes, there's one thing I can say is that Chief Brickner definitely had community service in mind when he took over. And there are a lot of programs that community outreach programs at the Valparaiso Police Department. I want to continue every one of those programs, do a review of each program, see if there's things that we can take to the next level. We're also in the process of reviewing additional community outreach programs that helps us interact with the community. I think that's the biggest part of crime prevention is community involvement. The citizens have to be comfortable with their police department to communicate with us, to reach out to us. I think together is how we move forward. That's my job. One of my visions are, community, improved community relations, inclusiveness, recruiting, diversification. Mm-hmm. I think we have to have a workforce that reflects our community. And I think with that, how we get that information is by partnering with the community to better our city.
And certainly goes along with Mayor Costas' overall plans as well, too, to be sure that the workforce at the City Hall and other elements of city government are diverse and work well with the community. Do you think that in the time that you've spent on the Valparaiso Police Department, that the relationship with the police department, officers, yourself, and others, and the community have gone pretty well?
Very well. I can say that prior to becoming chief, I was involved with a lot of the community outreach programs. And every time we've hosted an event or gone to events, the community support that we had is fantastic. And I think that that's such an important part for the city and our community as a whole.
Chief Mallon, let me ask, it's not easy being a police officer. It's certainly considered one of the most dangerous jobs you could ever have. And you're lucky that the force in Valparaiso is able to deal with the problems that pop up and go home in the evenings and tell your family and loved ones that everything went pretty well. Is there anything that you would tell the community that they should know, if they don't already know, about the life and career of a police officer and why it's important for the community to try to work well with police departments?
Well, I think the number one thing to remember is that police officers live in the community that they serve. They have families, they have wives, children, brothers, sisters. The success of our community and the safety of our community is just as important to the officers as it is to the neighbors that we live next to. I think that's probably the biggest thing that I would like to see, and I think as a whole we have that. Is that, we're part of the community when we're on duty and when we're off. And I think, it's important that we continue to communicate, continue to remember that we all want our communities safe. We all want better lives, and that we're people too. And I think that that's important to realize and to understand.
Well, Chief Mallon, it sounds like you're very excited to be starting out in this new venture for you, being promoted to be the police chief in Valparaiso, and it looks like a lot of great things are going to happen in the years ahead.
I hope so. I'm looking forward to taking the department, working with the community, working with the officers, and going to a new level.
That is Valparaiso Police Chief Jeff Mallon. A popular activity that's trending all around the country is finding its way now into Indiana. You get locked in a room with friends and maybe even some strangers, and you have an hour to get out. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Joe Wren visited the latest escape room that's set up in Bloomington, Indiana, to see how it's catching on there.
You know what? Come in and I'll show you how we can get out.
If you've never been, think puzzles, theater, teamwork, and brain power. The more puzzles you solve, the quicker you open doors and find your way out of the room. Locked Up Bloomington owner Stacy Reisdorf says each room has a storyline, too.
You are a secret agent, but you're captured, so you start off in handcuffs right here.
A game master listens and watches your every move through infrared cameras, so if you get stuck, you can ask for help. We can't tell you too much about the game room or we'd give away the puzzles. Players do have 60 minutes to escape, but game designer Craig Mapes says the staff has just as much fun as the players.
It's more, what's the word, addicting? Actually, they're addicting to me, and I build them.
Locked Up plans to expand to Mishawaka, Fort Wayne, and Indianapolis. Other local game puzzlers say the escape room market hasn't hit its ceiling. Enigma Puzzle House is Bloomington's first escape room. Game designer David Frew says the most difficult part of the business is creating the rooms themselves. But that's what makes every escape room different.
Here, you're dealing with the real world. It's a real space, which means that people can climb on tables. People can flip things upside down. They can interact with your game in ways that you didn't predict.
File this one under unresolved.
They plan to open their third room by the end of the month. Enigma Puzzle House owner Scott Smith calls their business the mom-and-pop model. They build and pay for it as they go.
We'll always have a crowd of people coming in because they know that there's going to be something different each time, something weird, something unique. And so we are only limited in that sense by our imaginations, which are pretty weird, I have to say.
Good luck.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Joe Wren.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This past weekend was the latest Gary International Black Film Festival held here in Gary, Indiana, in the hometown of our next guest. Karen Toering is the founder as well as the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival that has just finished up here, and Karen's with us in the studio. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having us, Chris. Well,
first off here, I have to ask, explain to people what the idea was behind the Gary International Black Film Festival that as you've envisioned it and brought it to life, and since we just finished up the latest festival, how it's turned out here. But a little history lesson first, please.
A little history lesson. Well, the festival was founded by a group of friends. We all grew up in Gary, all went to high school here, et cetera, et cetera. And it was, we all love film. I mean, we're not necessarily film scholars, but we really love film and television and movies and things like that. And so the idea was, well, what if we could put together a collection of really great independent films and, you know, we like it. Would anyone else, you know, want to come and see those films? And so we tried it. 7 years ago, we rented the Glenn Theater in Gary, and we, you know, brought films and filmmakers together and people in conversation, and nobody was more surprised than we were that people really, really enjoyed it.
Do you recall any of those films that you first showed 7 years ago in that very first festival?
Oh, I recall every single film. Remember 7 years ago, we did it in February. Mm-hmm. And if everybody remembers, there was a snowstorm of like biblical proportion in that, like, I was like a week before the film festival. And we opened the festival with a film from a then relatively unknown filmmaker. She was well known within the independent film community, but not nationally known. And that was our first film was I Will Follow by a filmmaker named Ava DuVernay. Mm-hmm. And we now know Ava as the director and producer of Selma, the director and producer of 13th. Some very, very powerful films that have come along in the last couple of years. And, you know, she came to our film festival first. It was the very first film we showed was her film.
Wow.
We also showed a film about the Black Panthers. And we had Fred Hampton Jr., Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., who joined us, and we showed a really powerful documentary about Haiti, which was done by a local filmmaker right after the storm. And so, yeah, I could tell you every single film, its length, the whole thing. It was a beautiful event, and we were like, maybe we should come back next year. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing that for the last seven.
For someone who's not familiar with the Gary International Black Film Festival, some of the information that's available online on the website kind of sums it up for somebody who's not familiar with it. Now, think of this in the future tense. Now, that not that it's just passed, but get ready for a weekend of powerful films, thoughtful, engaged discussions, and a host of exciting themes and ideas that tell the stories of the lives of Black folk. And that's pretty much the about the goal. That's about the well, it has been ever since the very first festival.
Exactly, exactly. Just an opportunity to use film as a catalyst for all kinds of discussion, for imagination. We had this year. We had a group of Black animators who brought their films to the festival, and we learned so much about, you know, why they got into animation and the kind of work that they do. We had a film about the Black middle class, and we had a really great discussion about displacement and gentrification and, you know, things that are very, very topical right now.
Tell us, if you will, about Black animation. That's something that people probably do not think about at all. I mean, you think about animation, and you think about the great films, of course, of the past, and the animators of today and what they're doing these mm-hmm. days, especially in the independent film genre. Mm-hmm. But Black animators probably have been flying under the radar
exactly.
for a lot of people, haven't
exactly.
they?
Exactly. And, you know, it's not I would say it's animators who are Black that work in that really diverse and vast fields. I mean, you know, there, if you think about all of the media that you see today, you know, a significant portion of it is actually animated. Think about like Blade Runner, you know, how many of the scenes in there, although they look incredibly human, are actually animation. Some of the, a lot of the sci-fi stuff is significantly animated. And these are people of color, you know, African American. And this group was African American women. There were a trio of African American women who were trying to break into the industry, emerging filmmakers doing short films on animation and hoping that, you know, their work gets noticed.
I have the information here from the schedule and what has been shown through the festival here. And one of them that stands out is the title of an animated film called Unplugged. If you will, tell us a little bit about that.
Let me see. You know, we had 33 films in the festival, and I'm going to have to do like you and actually look up Unplugged. It's
I just picked one. There are others too, but I thought that might be of interest to talk to people about in particular. It kind of stood out when I was looking through the schedule from online as well,
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, that was on Saturday morning, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Unplugged, let me look here, because I have to actually, people ask me this all the time, and they're like, what's playing? I'm like, I don't know, it's a lot of things. That's Malik Bolton, who's actually a regional filmmaker. Mm-hmm. It's a little story about, you know, any kid in any place, you know, in America who is connected and plugged into technology and has to sort of navigate his world when his headphones break and he has to actually take in all of the, you know, the street noise and the sounds and all of the world around him and what that means.
Well, you're about sound rich productions, and that probably had to be one of the most sound rich you could think of.
It was incredible. Yeah, and I think Malik is a regional filmmaker who graduated out of one of the tech schools in Chicago whose mm-hmm. name I can't remember now because, of course, I'm on the radio and my brain has just basically...
It's been a very busy week.
I know.
We're going to talk a little bit about the prep for that. One other film I wanted to mention, because we talk about Chicago area films and filmmakers, and one that just stands out too as well is a film that was shown during the festival this year entitled Blueprint for Bronzeville.
Oh, man, that was such an incredible film. The filmmakers came actually and brought one of the principal figures that they documented in the film. And it's just about the fight for housing. You know, housing prices are skyrocketing as neighborhoods change and improve. And it asks the question, you know, how can we preserve the legacy of families and homes and neighborhoods while welcoming new families into neighborhoods as, you know, our technology and growth patterns change.
We're talking with Karen Toering, who is the creator, the founder, and the director as well of the annual Gary International Black Film Festival. They just wrapped up this past weekend in Gary, Indiana. And as you mentioned, the very first film festival 7 years ago, the films were shown at the great little theater, the Glenn Theater, which mm-hmm. is on Ridge Road, just immediately to the west of Broadway,
right
in Gary. And this past session, I've been held. We've actually seen films at a great venue,
right.
The Berglund Auditorium on the IU Northwest campus.
For the last 6 years, we've reached out to Chancellor Lowe. And he's invited us to, well, we ask if we could sponsor and partner with Indiana University. And, you know, since their goal is to be, you know, accessible to the community, they took us on a gamble the first, you know, well, it was the second year of the festival, but the first year of our relationship with IU Northwest. And it's just been a joy to work with the folks over at IUN.
Now, when you talk about setting up a festival such as this here, and you talk about the very first one and how you had to fight the bad weather and everything to make it a success. For this year, when it's a case, since you're a native of Gary and you have family here in Gary, mm-hmm. so that gives you a chance to come back here, but you don't live here the rest of the year, I understand.
No, but I do come back often, friends and family. I mean, just as, you know, when you move away from home, you come back throughout mm-hmm. the year. But now when I come back, I have stuff to do. So there's not as much time to visit friends and family, but I do reside in Seattle, Washington. Mm-hmm. I've lived there for the last 17 years, yeah.
And I also understand too, that you're very much involved in the kind of a companion film festival out there, the Langston Hughes African American Film Festival.
Yes.
So you're a consulting producer. So you help work with those people too, and take everything that you know about the films and what you actually have kind of learned as well in helping organize this festival here in Gary, and help them out as well too. So you bounce back and forth from one coast to nearly another, and you make visits here, of course, take advantage of the chance to visit family members here at home. What kind of work do you have to do then in those trips back and forth, aside from the phone calls and the emails and everything else, to set up each film festival as we get a chance to see it every year?
Well, see, that's the secret sauce.
Oh,
that's the secret sauce. No, we have
and you shouldn't be revealing that, right?
No. We should be revealing the secret sauce, because there's a core team of about seven people here, right here in Gary, who live here, who basically do all of the, you know, coordination and the groundwork on the festival. And I just get to call in once a month and see how it's going.
But I suppose it's important, because if you're kind of spearheading things, especially since you're the guiding force through all of these years so far, that they're going to work extra hard not only to make the next festival or that particular festival coming up a great one, but you want to make it as better or better than the year before. You just have that goal that you want to do do a single year ahead and make sure that the following year, like I'm sure you're probably already looking ahead to the 8th annual film festival. Although you're not thinking about it right now, since the 7th just ended this weekend.
Yes, we are. Actually, we have a meeting tonight, and actually the festival planning for 2018 begins today. So we do, we announce the awards. We have to go through and tally all of the audience votes. It's a competition festival. So filmmakers do receive awards for best narrative, best documentary, best short, best youth, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll be doing that today. And announcing it tonight, and then, you know, literally we hit the ground running on Tuesday, building sponsorships, looking for films, and doing all of the background stuff.
And since you mentioned you have a number of young women who have been working on as the animation producers on their particular films that you're showing during the festival, they're probably all nervous and hoping that they'll be able to pick up an award too.
Yeah, in fact,
and they'll have to find out tonight.
We do. We got texts last night from filmmakers that were basically, "Did I win?" And it's like, "Oh, you're going to have to wait for the rest of the world and find out later tonight if you won." But we had some the other interesting thing about this year as opposed to the past six is mostly the festival is partially curated. We invite films, and then we have an open call for work submissions. And this year, almost, I'd say 97% of the festival was films that were submitted from,
that's interesting.
From around the world.
That open call really, really gets people's attention, apparently. And if you get them from around the world, you come up with the diversity, literally the diversity of films that you really want, and that you want people here in Northwest Indiana in particular, or the people coming into Northwest Indiana from wherever, to actually get a chance to see.
Exactly. And, you know, we had films this year from Iran, South Sudan, Uganda. I think we had a couple of films from Ghana, you know, we never know from year to year, you know, who's paying attention and, you know, who wants to, you know, get into the film, into the festival.
Did you have a point of getting towards the end of the submission process that you just had so many films that came in, you couldn't fit them all in for this year anyway? And you
every
have to,
year.
Something to look forward to for next year,
that
I suppose.
That happens every year. And the submission process, you know, we have a set, this particular Gary team actually sat down and said, you know, how are we supporting filmmakers, you know, to encourage them to do their best work? So each film submission that comes in that we reject, we send them a little note that says, okay, this is why your film did not make it into the festival. And, you know, try next year, you know, because we really appreciate the fact that you want to bring your handcrafted work for our audiences to see.
Now, have you had any films that have had to submit more than 1 year before they finally got displayed and shown and voted on?
Yeah, a couple. You know, we have a open submission process that, you know, lasts for about 6 to 10 weeks, depends mm-hmm. on. And we have had a couple of, in fact, we've had some, like one of the animators, Chaz Bottoms, submitted this year, and he actually won last year.
That's great. That's mm-hmm. great. Oh, we just have time for one last question from you, Karen. And I guess it is now that you've wrapped up another year, the 7th annual Gary International Black Film Festival, and the planning process gets to begin soon for the 8th annual event, too. Are there any films or any topics in particular that you would like to bring up in the next series of films that will be shown back here in Gary, Indiana next year?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there. You know, many of the films that we show have a connection to just the complexity and diversity of our community. So we're always looking for films like that. In fact, we have, through our partnerships, the festival is only one event in an entire year of programming. It's like the culminating event. Mm-hmm. But for example, this Wednesday, we're partnering with Purdue University Northwest to show a film called 13th, which is about basically about the school-to-prison pipeline and the over-incarceration of communities in the United States. And so we'll be doing those kinds of little pop-up film events in partnership with organizations throughout the community all throughout the year. And so as far as, you know, we always want to hook a big fish. Mm-hmm. You know, like this year, there's another film festival in a town about 30 miles away called Chicago. You know, a little old place called Chicago. And they opened with a film that we really tried to get, a film mm-hmm. called Marshall, about Thurgood Marshall. And so as a small film festival, we faced that kind of challenge of other very large film festivals, basically, you know, kind of.
Maybe we'll get to see Marshall next year.
Yeah. What? We probably, if we got a hold of that film, we'd probably screen it this year.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Karen Toering is the creator and the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival that's just wrapped up here in Gary, Indiana this past weekend. And Karen, thank you very much for being with us here on the program today, and the best of luck to you, and hope that looking forward to have a chance to chat with you again here next year, hopefully before we all get started and have a chance to kind of preview what's coming up for the next film festival ahead. Thank you for coming by today.
Okay. Thank you, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. As state lawmakers get ready to expand pre-kindergarten, there's a very successful program now in its 7th year this fall here in Lake County, the Building Brickies Early Learning Program in Hobart. I had a chance to speak with Laura Kovats with the School City of Hobart about the program that empowers parents to be their child's first and hopefully best teacher.
Our Building Brickies program, which has been around since 2009, focuses solely on children who have not entered kindergarten yet. Hobart, School City of Hobart, has a wonderful focus and goal of having all of their 4-year-olds in preschool. It's so important for them to be in a quality preschool before they ever go into kindergarten in School City of Hobart. So the whole focus of Building Brickies is a program that works with parents to empower them to be their child's first and best teacher. If parents are involved in their child's education and they have really great neurological information, they can really help their child be so successful when they get into kindergarten. So Building Brickies, we offer many components to families as they begin their journey towards school. One of the things we offer to families are home visits, where we visit them in the home and we show parents all kinds of ways through play that they can help their child reach all of their developmental milestones. We also offer monthly play groups here at the Early Learning Center at George Earl Elementary. We offer developmental screenings, possible referrals out to intervention services if that is necessary for children. If something is identified as being a potential delay, we put them into contact with like First Steps, NISEC, things like that, so children can get help early on. We also have resource referrals within the community. And the heart of all of this in Building Brickies is school readiness. Mm-hmm. How can we work with parents so that their child enters school not just ready, but more than ready to learn?
Now, I understand that this program is patterned after a much larger national program. Tell us about that and how you all were able to adapt this national program to create Building Brickies.
We use the Parents as Teachers curriculum, which is a wonderful curriculum focused on children ages prenatal through kindergarten entry. And we are approved curriculum users of parents as teachers. We follow all of their standards as far as monthly home visits and screenings and all of that. And we use their curriculum to teach parents all about how to help their children achieve all of their developmental milestones, including language, cognitive, social, emotional, fine motor, large motor. And through that curriculum, it really helps parents understand how their child's brain optimally develops, how they can use certain times in their child's development, and using play-based learning to really help them achieve all of their developmental milestones, which will really make them successful when they get into school. Parents as Teachers curriculum is absolutely wonderful, and we love using it.
Now, I imagine that even though you don't get into much of the medical terms or the medical details into this, but I'm sure that in the process, the parents get ready to know more about their youngsters' brains by learning a little bit how they basically work.
Another component that we've been using in collaboration with School City of Hobart and our local preschools, as well as working with our families in the home, is we're using mindfulness curriculum to help parents work with their children so children can learn all about how their own brains are developing so that they can be telling parents that they understand when they're feeling strong emotions, things like that. So mindfulness is really helping parents, as well as preschool teachers, everybody involved in the life of a child's development, better understand how a child's brain develops and how we can best support them on their journey in getting ready for school.
I know that you have a lot of help and a lot of assistance from a lot of organizations in Hobart to help make the Building Brickies program so successful so far here. One of them is the St. Mary Medical Center, and I'm sure that there are staff members there that have helped you all in helping create this program so the parents know better, they can recognize certain things.
Oh, St. Mary's Medical Center from day one has been such a wonderful support to Building Brickies, but they also provide so much wonderful support just to the School City of Hobart overall. Everything that they do to help all different aspects, including our early childhood program, they're such a wonderful referral for us. It's such a great relationship that we have built with them, and it's one that we value very much with St. Mary's. And they're, along with other organizations like Hobart Community Foundation, Hobart Educational Foundation, they're getting ready to have their big fundraiser. We're so excited to support them. So many local businesses that really get behind us because our funding does not come through the School City of Hobart. As we all know, education budgets are so tight. There's just nothing in the general fund that could support a program like this. Mm-hmm. So then we rely completely on grants like the one that we just received from the Legacy Foundation, through local donors, private citizens, businesses, and we also do our fundraising. In the spring, we always have Spring Fest, and the proceeds benefit our program. And through that collaboration of different funding that we receive, we're able to then provide all of these services to our families completely free of cost.
Now, as we know that the Indiana Department of Education and other related agencies down in Indianapolis are looking forward to the efforts to expand pre-kindergarten. We know they're working on trying to expand to three-year-olds and four-year-olds. Even with the pre-first grade and pre-kindergarten plans that they have they had any staffers look into the Building Brickies program to see how it works and see what they in turn can recommend when it's time to make some adjustments in the pre-K program statewide?
Well, we have met with people locally who are involved in that through our Ready, Set, Go program. We meet with mm-hmm. preschool providers themselves who work very closely with members from the state. And early on when that was all getting started and they were looking for local sponsors to get involved with that as well, we were involved in that. We are so supportive of making sure that every child can be in preschool by age four, and it's something that we support completely.
Laura Kovat says that she gets requests for information about the Building Brickies program from parents in cities outside Hobart. It's Monday. That means it's time once again for John Cain of South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, the music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Welcome back, Kirk.
Hi, John. Thanks very much.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the first classical concert of the 76th season of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra is approaching. The Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan.
Most wonderful of operettas. And, you know, just it's such lovely music. You go out whistling it. It's hilarious. It's funny. It's, of course, that huge takeoff on the British aristocracy and king and queen and stuff, mm-hmm. all in the guise of Japanese fun. Right?
It's the music is so It's so fun.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Just hilarious. And Gilbert with those lyrics. And we will have super titles, you know, because they just go by so quickly.
You know, that's what it sounds like,
yeah.
too.
Chippy, choppy, 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 chop. Yeah. And of course, the plot, as you well know, John, is hilarious. You know, if you flirt before the age of 40, you must have your head cut off. And you have your head cut off by, you know, Coco, you know, because he was just released from prison. He was a tailor and he was just made the Lord High Executioner. And it's really bad because he's flirting also, which means he must cut his own head off. You know,
why did he have to go to jail? Why did this tailor have to go to jail?
No reason at all.
I see.
Yes, just
is
like
this some mystical, I can't remember. Is it some set in some mystical land or is it Japan?
It's in Japan.
It's
and of
in
course
Japan. Okay.
This is in the moment in Britain when the first ambassadors to Japan come to London and Sullivan and Gilbert are completely taken by, you know, the Japanese play, the Japanese tea setting, the Japanese customs, the way they walk, their kimonos, the women's feet that are bound. So they take this whole exotic thing
very
for
exotic.
Them, very exotic, and they just transplant it into a huge a comedy, you know? So it was fascinating.
Were they making fun of the Japanese?
No, not at all. They were amazed by the silks that they wore and the way the women wore their hair and the makeup. And it was just like the whole society was like, oh, my gosh.
And this was a time when Japanese culture became fascinating in general.
Absolutely.
To the British people.
Yes, right around the turn of the century at the end of, you know, once Victoria is dead, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
1901. But it's really the precursor when we all think about it to, you know, a musical comedy, to vaudeville, to Broadway, you know, and it's in English. And there is, you know, Nanki Poo, the son of the emperor of the Mikado, is traveling in disguise now as a second trombonist.
Ah. Oh.
Okay, which goes along with our 76 trombones.
So this is a concert version of the operetta at it will be performed at Bethel Church. And so will there be costumes?
Yes, there will be costumes and wigs and makeup and a huge sword to decapitate, you know.
The three little maids from school.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to be in costume.
Yes, in costume,
oh,
too.
That'll be fantastic.
Now, we won't be able to move that much. We'll have to figure out how we move on this small stage because we've got a whole chorus, a whole orchestra, and nine people on the stage. So they'll come and go and, you know.
Well, now, who are your singers?
Oh, two of them, Sam Handley and David Govertson, just graduated from the Lyric Ryan program, that wonderful program. And Alyssa, who plays Yum Yum, was our star in the Rodgers and Hammerstein concert last year that everybody loves so much. I mean, those are three of them, but they're just wonderful. I did this show in Chicago last year with almost the same cast, and people adored it. And, you know, I know it's going to be tremendous fun.
Tremendous fun. Topsy Turvy is a movie about. Is this a production of Mikado?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I can't remember.
Yeah, Topsy Turvy is the Academy Award winning a movie that was made about Gilbert and Sullivan, but focuses on exactly the time of the Mikado, how it became, how they produced it, how they learned to move, all these beautiful things. So I'm going to show part of Topsy Turvy in the pre-concert lecture just to let people watch some of the movie and see the genesis of the piece.
Yeah, I remember loving that movie. But I have a gift for forgetting movies.
Uh-huh.
I saw Gosford Park like three or four times before I could remember who did it. And I've only watched now Gosford Park since then about a dozen times. I love that movie. Well, Kirk, great. That sounds like a lot of fun. The Mikado, can't wait. I'm looking forward to it immensely. And thank you for being here to tell us about it.
Oh, thanks. It was a great interview.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and join us next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation on Regionally Speaking. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, we'll find out more about an innovative high-tech program in the Michigan City area schools.